Hello and welcome to the March edition of TechIE. TechIE is a radio program put on by the New Hampshire section of the IEEE. The IEEE, or the Institute of Electronics and Electrical Engineers, is a worldwide organization of engineers. IEEE, Advancing Technology for Humanity. This month I've got with me Robert Smith of the Power and Energy Society. Robert Smith is a member of the IEEE. And he has been a member for
probably 30 years.
For 30 years. Wow. Okay. And Rob has put together an excellent show for us this month. We're going to talk about solar panels, also known as photovoltaics, and we'll get more into all the distinctions there. And if we have some time, we're also going to talk a little bit about electric vehicles and the infrastructure here in the state of New Hampshire. If you like what you're hearing today, you can check out our website at IEE-NH.org and find out what meetings are upcoming. If you are not a member, please, if you like what you're hearing, please consider becoming a member. This month as a special guest, we've got Eric St. Pierre joining us from Revision Energy. How are you doing today, Eric?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. So let's start off with the solar panels and the photovoltaics here in New Hampshire. Now, Eric, can you tell us a little bit about where you're coming from and who you work for and that kind of stuff?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So, you know, my history is something of, you know, long time in the construction industries and the trades. Spent some time dealing with the frustrations of being a labor worker, but also more or less the sustainability issues that I saw within that industry and not being able to make a change. Got lucky and caught wind of Revision Energy early on, partnered with them, and they took me on board. And now what I do is I'm a solar designer. I design solar systems and renewable energy projects, demand management, energy profiles, all sorts of services for the residential homeowner in the state of New Hampshire.
Well, solar designer sounds really cool.
It sounds cool. There's a lot that goes into that as well. I get to design systems, which is really cool. But really, at the end of the day, it's me educating the customer base in New Hampshire about what's available to them and what solutions we can provide them.
So if I, as a homeowner, call you up, right, and I say, hey, my neighbor's got solar panels on his house, I'd like to have the same. What is the process from the first phone call? That is interesting to me.
Yeah. No. What will typically happen is if you're calling in, you're interested in solar, you found us and you give us that phone call, we're going to have a renewable energy advisor who will answer that phone call. And what they'll do is they'll just start the process, start asking the typical questions. You know, what's that average electric bill? How do you heat your home? Is it with oil, natural gas, propane? And start to paint the picture of the energy uses that you currently have. Combined with that, what we do is we utilize technology at its fullest. We'll check satellite images. We'll see what a home looks like from its aerial view so we can determine if it's got a good roof surface, if we do want to continue the conversation on solar. So from that point in time, that's when the renewable energy advisor will determine, is this a good opportunity for this client? Should we send somebody out to do a further review? So to actually meet that client in person and to talk more about that opportunity.
And is it fair to say that more, as far as residential installations, you do more on rooftop than on the ground, I'm thinking?
Well,
is that not necessarily so?
You know, yes, in the past, but as time goes on and we improve our techniques, the technology, we are doing more and more ground-based systems for sure.
So, Eric, I have a question for you. You talked about the roof, but I also have been... You know, I'm in the process of buying a house, mm-hmm. and I happen to do this drive-by, and there's this beautiful house, but they've got their solar panels out in the yard. I mean, how often does that happen?
It's becoming more and more frequent now. What we see is we're actually getting the request for it. You get clients who are not interested in installing something on their roof and, you know, potentially compromising that roof surface. From our perspective, we've installed well over 6,000 systems at this point in time on a roof. No leaks, no issues. But again, there's that honest concern from the homeowner who says, this is my roof and you're doing what to it? So no, there's always that that request, that option. We can always look into putting something on the ground. And then that leads into other technologies. We can utilize, what they call a fixed ground mount, where it's something that stays stationary. Mm-hmm. Or we can utilize a tracking type structure where, you know, typically what we'd offer is a dual axis tracking system that'll both follow the up and down tilt and the left to right tilt of the sun throughout the day.
Right. The east-west, right? The
east-west
and then the angle above the horizon, right?
Correct.
Cool.
Do you ever have to get a structural engineer involved? Is that something that happens?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's become more and more as time goes on with the proliferation of solar. If you would have gone back a few years, really, it was kind of the Wild West of solar, where there really wasn't a lot known about what do we want to do in regards to putting solar on the home, and how do we want to, what steps do we want to go through? And what had happened is it became more known and more normal across the state. A lot of the local building officials started to say, hey, I think we should probably double check here. We should probably do something. So a lot of what's happened now is the last few years, a lot of towns now require a structural analysis on the home. Yeah. So part of what we go through, it's the professional engineering stamp, and we get the approval on the home, gives us the thumbs up to install on that roof.
Now, speaking of the town requirements, what about... Do you run into zoning problems? I don't know if that applies to...
No, it does. So you run into issues, especially if we start talking ground-mounted structures. Mm-hmm. We'll have setback issues. And again, that'll vary town to town. So it plays to our benefit for being in the area for so long and knowing these towns so well.
Right.
Because you can go from one town to the next and it can be a completely different scenario.
Sure. And taxation too, right?
Correct. Taxation from town to town is different. There's some that will currently exempt any additional taxing from their the value increase of solar. But then there's some that don't. So knowing in your town before you go solar what that means for you in your town, it will impact what that investment looks like for you.
So I would think with that kind of expertise, the homeowner calls you, says, I have no idea what I'm doing. You probably help give them some guidance with if they're going to interconnect with the utility, interconnection agreement, I assume that you have expertise to lend there as well.
Yeah.
And that's a good service to offer.
The interconnection in and of itself is another talking point where you guide the customer to know, hey, if we build a system within a certain size range, we're most likely okay on this interconnection. It's just going to be an application that goes forward to the state. They review it. They approve it. Now, if we build a system of 10 kilowatts or larger, that's going to trigger a different review from the utility. It lets them kind of look at what their infrastructure says, and are they going to be able to accommodate that potential backfeed load that your new system is going to put onto that grid. So, no, we do. We have to guide through that, and it's a process of unknowns sometimes because really we can't get any answers on that until the utility does their review.
Right. Well, one of the questions I had is, suppose I do get solar panels put on the roof of my house. Does that mean I'll be able to disengage from the power grid entirely, or will I still want to stay connected? Or what are some of the factors involved with that?
No, that's a really good question. The way it stands right now is that you're going to want to stay grid tied, and that's what we truly specialize in. And the reason that is we have what's called net metering in our state, and that is the opportunity that allows us to export that excess energy that we make during the nice sunny days with our solar systems back to the grid. The grid now, you know, Eversource, Unitil, Liberty, the major utilities in our state will now bank that energy for us, credit it, and then in nighttime, cloudy days or whatnot, they'll give it back to us. So yes, we do want to stay connected to the grid. You do have the opportunity, as you had in the past, to go off grid. And, you know, we have great opportunities now that we have a lot of really good technology around the lithium ion battery. But at the same time, you're hard pressed to go that direction because it's a luxury item, if you would, for these systems. Now, we don't need a battery system to operate. The battery system does help to utilize that solar during a grid power outage.
Right.
But if somebody already has a generator in place, or if they're not too worried, or the history of power outages hasn't been that big in their area, there's really no need to utilize a battery at this time.
Now, is net metering, does that mean, I think I know what it means, but I'm not sure. I buy so many kilowatt hours in a month. I put onto the grid so many kilowatt hours in a month. That difference, and I pay my normal rate, or do I pay my normal rate for what comes in and I get paid perhaps a different rate for what I sell to the utility?
Pretty close. So really what it comes down to is you're going to export your energy if there's excess. That will now offset whatever you're pulling from the grid. Now, at the end of the month, if what you've exported is more than what you've imported, you've netted out and you've now credited your account. If it was just shy of saying covering all that usage for the month, you pay your traditional rate,
your normal rate for
what you've used above and beyond what you've generated.
Okay.
But that's the typical net metering explanation. And that's what's allowed solar to grow and proliferate as it has.
Sure.
And that net metering right now has been one of the major concerns of the solar industry in New Hampshire right now, because it's been under attack for the last few years. And we're going to see that net metering rate structure. So what they currently call it is it's a one-to-one net metering rate, just meaning if you send a unit of electricity to the grid, you're mandated to get that full unit of electricity back. The utilities in their business model want to see that the homeowners who go solar pay their fair share of the upkeep of the utility grid. So their argument has always been that there'll be a cost shift to solar. Right. The more people go solar, and who's going to upkeep that cost? They have a valid argument, but we're decades away from that being a true issue for the utilities. So what we have coming up actually this June 2nd, we're most likely going to see the net metering rate in New Hampshire change from something like 1-to-1 to 1-to-75%. In favor of the utility. Mm-hmm. So just meaning that the utilities are only going to compensate you for a portion of what you export to them.
So if I think about what my electricity bill looks like, right? I get charged a certain value. I think it's called delivery charge. And that's based upon how many kilowatt hours I bought. And presumably, I think that's the same for every, at least residential customer. So is what you're saying that if the net is a really small number, they don't want you to only pay delivery charge on that value of kilowatt hours, because they have to still have the entire grid intact when you need it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, essentially what it is if I design a system appropriately for your home, we're going to look at it from that 12-month usage profile. We're going to see what do you use in the course of 12 months and what can my system now produce over that 12 months, and can we...
Right.
offset that whole system. And that's usually the goal for most homeowners. And when you do, the months that you've now produced enough and offset and actually exported energy, your bill will go down to zero on all your kilowatt line items.
Right.
So essentially your delivery, the transmission, the stranded cost charges, all those. But what will be remaining is the customer charge. Oh. If you look at the top of your bill, that's your first line item, usually between $12 and $15, mm-hmm. depending on the utility. So a house that uses no electricity will still pay that charge, solar or no solar.
Okay. Right. Just to keep the upkeep of the grid. I mean, somebody has to pay for that.
Yeah, we call it, your connection to the grid fee, or, when we're talking solar, it's essentially our battery fee, $12, $15 a month charge so that we can utilize the grid as a battery. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it from that perspective, it's well worth the money spent.
Now, you did mention the safety, I think you did, of electrical workers. Mm-hmm. I think you mentioned that in passing. I think people work for the utilities. Mm-hmm. What about firefighters?
Yeah, that's a...
I was thinking about that yesterday, thinking, if I were a firefighter and I saw an electrical system that's standalone, can generate, and I've got to go in and fight a fire, I don't know what you do there.
Yeah, no, it's another area that is, ongoing research, ongoing changes in code. Most recent for the state of New Hampshire is that we've adopted what's called a rapid shutdown code, which just means that somewhere on that system, and it has to be visible on the outside of the building, that we have some sort of a quick shutdown of the system that would render it depleted of its energy within a 10-second period. So that you could have a firefighter come to the home, see that, flip the switch, and then be able to access the roof and do what's needed to be done.
Right.
It's something that we're always educating on. One of our founders of Revision is a fire chief.
Mm-hmm.
So it's worked out very nicely where he's very educated on solar and how it works, but he also lives on the other side. And he can really go and educate the firefighters and their practices and how best to go about dealing with a PV system when they come about seeing one.
Excellent.
So I have a question. I think that at one point, if you went solar, you had to have DC appliances that would operate off a DC current. Is that still the case, or has solar, you know, joined the grid in being AC current?
No, that's a really cool question. So if you go back to when we were just doing off-grid systems,
yeah,
yes, you benefited greatly from having DC only appliances in the house because you could essentially eliminate that inverter,
right,
that we're utilizing now. So the basis of a system now is photovoltaic cells on the roof, affixed by some sort of a racking structure, connected down by some wiring, internally, externally run on the house, but meeting up with that inverter at some point, maybe basement, outside, really many places that we can put that, and then feeding that into the home's main panel so that we can utilize that energy. So no, DC appliances have kind of gone by the wayside unless you're still an off-grid user who's really just trying to eke it out way off the beaten path.
Yeah, well, it probably was many years ago when I saw this.
And I suppose you also mentioned something I just want to touch on. The inverter has to somehow synchronize with the grid. I assume that's all contained in one device?
Yeah, essentially what we're using right now are grid-tied inverters. They need to sense the sine wave from the grid to operate. And once that's gone, that inverter
they
will automatically
fire themselves
shut down.
That way. Okay.
Yeah. And that goes back to that safety that we were talking about. That's when you have that photovoltaic system on the home and grid power outage happens. That way we've now killed that system. Yep. We're not backfeeding anything to the utility and harming any of those line workers.
Right.
Okay. Right. So if the grid goes down, even though I've got solar panels, I'm out of power too.
Yep. And that's something that's a little difficult for the new customer to swallow at first, because if they've come at it thinking that that's part of the solution, then yeah, that's a little tough. But we usually get past that when you talk about, in most locations, what the historic power outages have been. And if you are in one of those areas, for the most part, we tend to see that those clients already have a generator or something as a backup source. And as long as our systems are aware of that generator, or we're aware, essentially, as we're designing it,
right,
everything will work as it did in the past, and no change, business as usual.
Yeah, well, I've been thinking about getting solar panels so that I wouldn't need the generator, because, you know, generators are loud and noisy. And...
Yeah. Well, all we have to do is add a battery, you know? And there's awesome, awesome cutting-edge solutions right now, but as anything that's cutting-edge, you know, there's a little bit of a price tag with that. So, you know, a typical battery solution for a photovoltaic system now, somewhere in the realm of $15,000 to $25,000, depending on size of system and what we're looking to do with it.
Right. And how much storage you want, right?
Yeah. And how much storage you want. What would you like to back up? What are your critical loads? What are you thinking about?
Right.
So, yeah, a lot of little design cues that go into figuring out, you know, what components are going to mate best and work best for your system.
I took a look online at the, by the way, speaking of, you know, clean energy, at what's called the Renewable Portfolio Standard for the state of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And I noticed that, and for those who might not be familiar with what that means, it's a commitment by, I don't know if it's all the states, but many states, to go to renewable sources of energy, a certain percentage by, like, you know, 2020 or 2025 or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
New Hampshire was, I think, around 8.5% last year, but took a huge jump this year up to 17%. That's, I guess, by the end of the year, they want to be 17% renewable. Anyway, I'm wondering, when they talk about these, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but I wonder if when they give these numbers, these percentages that they want to, these target percentages, does that include all the residential clean, you know, renewable power around the state? Does that include just the big power companies? Are you familiar with that at all, or how that works?
So for the RPS, what the utilities are trying to do, and you explained it, is they're trying to hit a percentage of their electric production as a renewable source.
Right.
And what will happen, and I don't know the last that any of us have heard, that, you know, our local utilities are building a renewable energy plant, but nobody's building any of this right now. So how are they expanding that portfolio? What are they doing to create a bigger base of renewable energy? And they're buying it off of the homeowners. They're buying it off the local businesses that have gone solar. Mm-hmm. Essentially, what happens is a system in the state of New Hampshire will get now recognized as a renewable energy producer. And by doing so, you get the benefit of renewable energy credits. Mm-hmm. Those credits get sold on an open market, and the utilities are the ones that buy them. And as they buy them, that's what helps bring up their portfolio and eliminates them from the chance of getting a penalty at the end of the year because of that RPS standard.
Right. So get the solar panels and help out the state.
Yeah.
And that, but that number also includes, I think you mentioned this earlier before we went on air, but that also includes clean energy credits from that may have been generated outside the state.
It can be. They don't have to particularly be purchased within the state. Right. You know, a lot of the New England states can trade amongst themselves. So yeah, it's really the utility. Where's that market? Mm-hmm. What are they trying to do? What are their goals? In Massachusetts, that standard's a lot stricter, and there's a lot more. There's a stronger market, if you would, and the value of those renewable energy credits in the Massachusetts market are a considerable amount more than ours.
Okay. Well, when we talk about renewables, though, we're not talking about just photovoltaics, though. We're talking about wind, right?
Sure.
Correct.
And actually, biomass is renewable. And wood products, any kind of wood products. Basically, anything that's not fossil fuel, I guess.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep. Yeah, because we could do renewable energy credits on a solar thermal system. And that's based off of the BTUs it creates. And you can have that factored in as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. The, you know, when I first bought my house, I wanted, you know, it's this big, old, drafty Victorian. I was thinking, wouldn't it be cool if I could run water up to the roof? Because the roof is always hot. It's one of these great houses. It's hot in the summer and cold in the winter. But wouldn't it be great if I could heat up the water and then bring the heat down to where it's cold? And that would be what you're talking about, the thermal solar?
Solar thermal is really exciting. It's cool. The technology itself has been pretty similar for the last few decades now. But what we really look at it and what can be harnessed for is really your domestic hot water use. Whenever we look at it as a potential for heating the home, we run into the issue that our regions offer us. So what we end up having is, when do we need the heat the most? When it's cold outside. And when it's cold outside, we have a little bit less solar access or sun intensity, if you would.
Right.
So what we tend to happen on solar thermal systems is you're just not as productive throughout those colder months, which means we need more and more thermal mass to be heated. And what happens is you reach a point where if you're trying to do it for heating purposes, that thermal mass could be so large that we're talking a whole basement would need to be, you know, loaded with water that you could now turn that, you know, transfer that heat energy into and have it sitting there waiting for you to pump it around the house and utilize it.
But don't we have a similar sort of issue? I mean, it is New Hampshire. I mean, there's only so much sun, right?
Yep.
So even in winter, when we would want more solar energy, we've got a shorter day.
Yeah, and that's correct. But what's really great and what we've found out over time is, like, if you look at, say, Germany, who's been kind of the poster child for kind of the leader, you know, worldwide for solar, we have a far better solar access than they do. We have a better sun intensity. So,
oh, really?
So a system, you know, if we put the same size system on a roof here in New Hampshire and the same size system on a roof in Germany and all things were considered the same, the system here would produce more electricity.
We have more sunny days? Is that the issue?
Well, I think it comes down to our region, the length of days, the sun intensity for this area. It's just that we have more sun hitting our surface here than they do in Germany. And you know, if you look at us latitudinally across the globe, we really line up pretty close. So it's a nice comparison. And when you look at it and the amount of solar deployment that they've had, you can really look back and start to say, okay, well, why haven't we gotten there yet?
Right.
Oh, we have too many trees in New Hampshire.
And this is the truth. This is the truth. Many a time the same exact process as what Rob brought up. You know, we start looking at those satellite images. And sometimes you have that conversation with the client and you say, well, where's your house? And it can take a little while because it might be that little speck that's poking out from the side of the trees. And then you have to have the hard conversation with the client to say, do you think you want to remove some trees or what are you thinking? And, you know, it's funny because the metric you can refer back to is, you know, for every kilowatt of solar that you install in your home, you're offsetting 5 acres of trees. So it's like planting an additional 5 acres of trees. So that can help sometimes when we, we're coming at it from the clean green side of things, and we're talking about cutting trees down.
Yeah. Sure. What kind of a factor do you get when you actually track the sun as opposed to having a stationary panel?
So essentially, when you have direct solar access from the sun and you have that perfect 90 degree from the panel to the sun, that's your greatest intensity. And that's the time of day when you're going to make the most electricity. So if you can now utilize a structure that will do that for you throughout the day, you can increase your generation by, say, 40, 45%. But it's very site specific, and you really have to have a site that lends itself to it. Because what the goal of a tracking system is to get that sun from dawn to dusk. And if you can do that, then you're really capitalizing on that investment.
Right.
And if you don't, you're somewhat shooting yourself in the foot where you paid for a great piece of technology. You're just not utilizing it to its fullest potential.
Do those systems work by knowing the track of the sun on a particular day, or are they always adjusting until they get a larger?
Sensor-based.
Yeah, sensor-based, right.
GPS-based.
You know, I've been thinking about these photovoltaics as actual panels. Like, they come in, because I'm ignorant, I'll make up numbers, 2 feet by 4 feet, right?
Yeah.
You buy X numbers of those. But I also have heard about, like, shingles to put on roofs that will also create energy.
Yep.
What kind of technology is available for solar panels, photovoltaics?
Well, the technology is always improving. There's always something else that's out there that we don't have access to yet that's still in its incubation phase. But, you know, we've seen solar tiles on the market. You know, over the last 10 years, somebody's tried to do something in some iteration. And I guess it goes back to talking about the solar panel first. So traditionally what you see in the residential market, commercial space, is either a 60 cell or a 72 cell solar panel. So what is that? You have your small solar cell that is either laid out 10 by 6 or 12 by 6 on a panel. And what that does is now you connect all those cells, and that's what's creating that panel. When we go through and do a solar shingle, more often than not, what we're utilizing is just a single one of those cells and building it into a small building product. The history on this is that the fair majority, and from my research on it, it was all but one of the companies that have gone down this path went out of business due to the fact that they're very hard to maintain from a system perspective. Because what would happen is, instead of having all of your cells in one panel, you now have them individualized in a single shingle. And all those single shingles need to be connected in a series. So what would happen is, much like the Christmas light.
One light goes out.
And even if it didn't, what would happen is, over time, you would start to have a system that you would just have gaps in that system. So slowly over time, not due to degradation of the system, but due to the fact that it was going faulty, you would just go down in production over time. And they were very, very hard to service, because a lot of time they were the type that kind of interlocked amongst one another. So if the one in the middle,
get one out if you needed
you to, need to peel off a half a roof just to get to the one in the middle.
Gotcha.
So what we've seen is a lot of that has gone out. But if you guys are familiar with Tesla's most recent product, they've now produced what's called the solar tile, and they've done the newest and neatest iteration of it, where they're doing a glass tile that has that solar cell embedded to it. And what they've done is, if you and I were to take that solar cell and look at it from the top, we'd see the solar cell. It would look like clear glass. But if you were to tilt it just a little bit, it's actually got louvers built into it that will now give it the image of a slate tile or an asphalt tile.
Oh, that's really cool.
So they're really neat. And as Tesla has in the industry, it creates a lot of hype around its product. And, you know, it's not anything that our residents in New Hampshire will see anytime soon. It's got to ramp up in manufacturing. It's got to get tested. It's got to come to fruition. But what we see is those products will be the future of solar, where we can really integrate directly into the roof. But there's still a lot of hurdles to get over.
Yeah.
The first generations of these solar tiles, a lot of their problems was their ability to dissipate heat because instead of like a traditional system now, we're putting it on a racking structure. It has an airspace between the panel and the roof, which is great for the panel. The cooler the ambient temperature, the more electricity you can produce. Well, if you've got this solar tile mated right to the roof surface, that heat just builds and builds and builds, and that would bring down the efficiency of the system as well. So it's kind of, you got to work out all those little quirks to really scale up.
And just one thing I've been curious about. Let's say I do it, I get the solar panels on my roof, and it snows.
Yeah.
Am I stuck until that snow melts, or is there anything like a heating element in the panels to kind of get that snow to melt off or something? Or
no, it's a good question. The panels themselves, there's no heating that we're gonna attach to them. There's no other external devices that we would utilize for that. There are some utility scale developments that if you look, they have all sorts of different devices that are starting to come out now that'll clean the panels. So different robotics and stuff that they're kind of working with that facilitate that. But for the general homeowner, no, there's a bunch of options. More often than not, we're going to tell our clients, do not go up on your roof, especially when it's snowy, and do not go clean off your panels. But in the case that it's easy, it's accessible, it's your house, if you felt that you wanted to clean off your panels, go for it. The typical practice of taking the roof rake and maybe putting a piece of pipe insulation on it on the end, or taking the old foam noodle from the pool, cutting it and putting it on, duct tape that on. That just gives you that nice little bit of, something that when you're up there and you're whacking, it's not that hard edge. You're not going to catch anything. It'll let you just kind of help that snow evacuate. And that's what we see as well. You take an asphalt shingle roof and switch it to a glass surface. More often than not, you're going to shed the snow. It just depends on the pitch of that roof. So if we're above 35 degrees on our pitch, we're going to see that snow shed pretty frequently. If we're below that, it may sit for a time. But that goes back to the work that we do on, evaluating and calculating what a system can truly produce. And we do our own calculations to predict what that snow D rate should be throughout the winter. We kind of have some historical values on the snowy years, the least snowy years. So we can kind of say, all right, there's probably about this much of time during the winter where you will have snow on the panels and won't be generating. So let's take that off and let's tell you that this is the amount you'll make throughout the year.
And what kind of maintenance otherwise besides snow does the system like this need?
None.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to talk long term, if you go in 20 years and out, potentially a replacement of the inverter.
So it comes down to life of the...
The product. The components themselves, because really, it's an electronic system. I mean, we've got some wires, we've got an on-off switch. Right. There's really nothing
No moving parts.
No moving parts. There's nothing for the homeowner to do. Yeah. My conversations with clients, it mostly is... just setting that expectation that we've got a workhorse to this system, and that's the inverter, and it has the potential to wear out over time. And really the working life of the common inverter right now is about 15 to 20 years. So just kind of having that in the back of your head and saying, okay, maybe at the 15, 20 year mark, somewhere in there, I'll have to replace the inverter. But the inverter in and of itself has come down in cost drastically over the last decade, and if not the last 5 years. So we see it as an item now that really, for what it is, it's going to be very cheap to replace in the future. And then again, it's still might not even be a piece of the PV system that we own in the future.
Right.
And that all plays into the future of the grid and the changes that we'll see happening over time.
What about the silicon right in the panels themselves? Does that degrade?
Yep. The silicon does degrade. We have essentially two types of silicon. Well, you can break it down a little bit more to roughly four types of silicon, but we have, what's referred to as poly or multi-silicon, multi-crystalline silicon. But essentially what it is that's a less pure form of silicon.
Right.
Has a few more elements that remain within the base of that silicon. Or we have what's called a monosilicon. So it's a little more pure. The other elements have been worked out of it, and it's said to degrade less. I mean, all the studies show that that's a better opportunity, I guess, if we want to look at the long-term reliance of the system. But we've got a lot of cool technologies going in multiple directions now, and where we would have thought a couple years ago that we'd all be just looking at mono silicon in our panels for years to come. There's been some nice advancements on the polysilicon side that we're actually still working with polysilicon, and those are still going up pretty frequently as well.
Excellent.
Just out of curiosity, suppose, you know, I do want to put this on my home. What kind of price range am I looking at?
It really, really all depends. But the general, I guess, averages at this time, I would say that, you know, the average system cost for a client is about $20,000 to $30,000.
Yep.
And that's, again, gross cost. That's before we talk about our incentives and our rebates. We still have a 30% federal tax credit available to us. So that's a nice little sum right off the top that we get back as a tax credit. And then the state actually still has a state rebate available.
Really?
That maxes out at $2,500. So, you know, any system that we install 5 kilowatts or larger, and just for perspective's sake, a 5 kilowatt system is roughly 16 to 18 panels at this time. So if you do 16 to 18 panels on the home, you can max out on your state rebate at $2,500. So, you know, the client who goes ahead with a $25,000 system at the end of the day has a net cost of about $12,000 to $14,000, and that can be a payback as soon as 6-7 years. So it makes for a pretty compelling set of economics when you start looking at it and start to see, wow, I'll own this system outright 6 to 7 years, and I'll have free electricity for, you know, next 20, 30 years. I mean, we engineer a system to last 40 years. That's what we think, that, you know, that system will be in service for that amount of time.
Right.
So if you look at it from that perspective, you're talking, you got 3/4 of the life of the system still to go, and you own it.
Right.
Wow.
It's, by the way, it's 5 kilowatts. Is that a sort of an average size you put? And I know it probably varies by whether it's a residential or commercial installation, but I'm trying to take 5 kilowatts and see what that compares to on an average home load.
You know, if you go back a few years, we would have said 5 kilowatt was the average. And and within the industry, it's what we reference a lot of the economics to. And it makes for a simple conversation.
Right.
But in what we've seen as of recently is really the average size of system has just continued to tick up. The more that people become aware that solar is a great tool to help manage the loads in the home, the more we're seeing larger and larger homes come into the mix and start to say, hey, how about me? And, you know, I would say average size of system right now is somewhere between 7 and 10 kilowatts in size.
Do you ever find that you're mixing, and maybe it's not just you folks, but are you mixing other renewable technologies in with solar? Is that a thing? Or do you see, well, you know, I've got this wind generator out back too, and I want to integrate that. Can you help us out?
I think that within the state, you'd find a lot of people that want to do a lot more of that.
Right.
What you run into is the wind runs into a lot of, I guess we could go back to kind of the zoning issues and a lot of permitting issues. And that comes with putting an 80-foot structure in your backyard.
Right.
You know, so you run into a lot of those issues. You don't always run into it when we want to do something on our roofs or in our backyards that people won't see. But when somebody wants to put a big propeller blade in their backyard that the neighbors might see, you get to have a lot of people sign off on that. So it's always that's always been a little bit of a hurdle for people to get past.
So what you're saying is the sun makes it to the ground, but the wind doesn't.
Yeah. And that's the other thing. Site specific for wind, it's a little bit more finicky to figure out the wind patterns in for residential areas, at least. I mean, if you're looking at doing a larger, well-sited wind site that you're doing on the ridge of a small hill, you can now tap into the jet streams and start to figure out, okay, we tend to see historic winds at this rates, and you can start to calculate that out.
And I guess, what you know, weather notwithstanding, you know when the sun is up, you don't know when it's going to be windy. But speaking of weather, I have a cloudy day. What do I expect to happen?
Yeah, you're still going to generate even on a cloudy day. Mm-hmm. It's drastically decreased because we don't have that sun's intensity. So, you know, again, that goes back to averages. When we calculate over a system, we're using the last 30 years of weather data to start to figure out what was the sunniest year on record, what was the least sunniest year on record. And let's blend those and let's figure out what we could figure out as an average for this system.
If it's wintertime, right, but let's say that I've oriented my solar panel in such a way that it's exactly the same, so it tracks the sun.
Yep.
Obviously, the panel itself is colder in the wintertime. Does that have an effect? Does the temperature have any effect on the output?
Yeah.
If the sun intensity is exactly the same.
Yep. The, you know, we see times of the year right about now, kind of that March time frame where we still have some cool temperatures, but we're getting a lot of that sun come up and we're getting the day just extended again on us.
Right.
Those are some of the days where we see the best production throughout the year because we've got the best max of sun intensity and that cooler temperature.
Oh, cooler's better, actually.
Cooler's better.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, what'll happen is...
I was thinking of batteries. I know my electric car. My battery likes the warmth.
Yes, it does. Okay. Yes. Driving up hills on a cold day will shorten that battery life. No, the temperature, so if it's kind of mid-July and we've got a really hot, hot summer going on, those panels are going to come down in their efficiency slightly. So, you know, you'll see that, you know, March and kind of end of September, you know, when we start to get those cooler days, but we still get the long sun.
Sure.
Those are some really, really awesome generation days for solar owners.
Now, have solar owners noticed their houses being cooler with the panels on the roof? I mean, I would think that they would shade the roof somewhat.
No, you're right on with that. I've had a few clients where we've talked about a room in the house that was historically hot. And it was hot because we maybe had a cathedral ceiling and it was like right there under the roof. And when you installed solar, you're installing a second roof that now you don't have that direct thermal transfer.
Right.
So, yeah, it does help cool some sort. Not directly cool, but it does help prevent.
It helps that buffer. Yeah.
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 No, it's really cool. There's been a few instances where that's been just a bonus to adding the system.
A nice
to the
bonus.
Home. Yeah.
This has been a great discussion on solar, Eric, and I'm really glad that you came and you talked to us. I hope you stick around for the electric vehicle.
Of course, I would.
Awesome. So if you're listening, if you like what you're hearing, please consider becoming an IEEE member. Also, if you are a member, please consider becoming a volunteer. We always need people to help do things like put together radio shows like this one. So Rob and Eric, what we're going to talk about in this segment of the show, and we've got about 15 minutes left, is electric vehicles and the infrastructure for electric vehicles in New Hampshire.
Sure.
Full disclosure, I'm a Prius owner.
Me as well.
And I actually drive a Nissan Leaf, so I've taken the full electric plunge.
Oh, really? You've gone the whole way.
That's right.
And how do you like it?
Well, it works out very well because for a commuting car, it's great. It's... You know, one quick anecdote is we're sitting in Bedford, New Hampshire. I live over eastern part of the state. I was a little bit uncomfortable coming from work in my Nissan Leaf because there is no backup. So it's a little bit out of the range. It probably is doable, but why risk it, right?
And right.
I alluded to a minute ago, they don't do that great in the colder parts of the year. That's the way the batteries operate. So it was a little bit out of the range anyway. So... Otherwise, it's a great car. It's great to drive into the gas station, but not buy gas. Go in there for something else, you know. So that's kind of cool.
A cup of coffee, maybe.
right. So, but no, I've I've really enjoyed it.
So what is the range on the Leaf?
The Leaf advertises I want to say 84 miles on a full charge. It's 24 kilowatt hours to give you an idea of what the battery on at least on mine, which was a 2015, I think, but. You have to use that number wisely because it does depend on speed. The faster I go, the more loss from friction occurs, and that will bring the you know, highway speeds. It doesn't do great at highway speeds, in my opinion. If you drive 25, 30, 40 miles an hour, you do great. The other thing is the time of year. So in the summertime, I can easily get 100 miles off a battery charge. No worries in the world. There are exciting, I think, developments there. Of course, Tesla came out with their longer range automobiles a few years ago. Most people can't afford them or don't want to spend that kind of money on an automobile. But Chevrolet is coming out with the Bolt. I forget which.
Bolt with a B,
right? And that's an all-electric. And they're advertising on the 2017 model over 200 miles.
Yep.
I think it's 60 kilowatt hours. So it's all about how much battery we can cram into the bottom of the car.
Mm-hmm.
one thing I have learned is that, you know, you don't have an internal combustion engine in the front of the car. It might be front wheel drive, but it's not necessarily very good on the snow because it's not, the weight's just
there's no weight over those wheels.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't had any close calls, but I could tell that this is, you know, not a great snow car, but again, you know, the truth of the matter is most of these are in the southwest and southern part of the country anyway. the infrastructure, as you mentioned, has been is an important thing. I think it's starting to come alive here in New Hampshire. We do have at least a couple of the high power charging stations, which makes it a much more practical vehicle to own.
So, do you know where these charging stations are?
Well, there's one here in Bedford, for example. Well,
yeah, we're in Bedford.
At Whole Foods.
Mm. Whole Foods.
Yeah, that's one right out front.
Pay attention, folks. Whole Foods in Bedford.
And these are DC. These at least the way the Leaf works, there are three ways to charge it. They comes with a portable charger that is really, I would say, for emergencies. If you're stuck somewhere, you can plug it into your friend's house or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that, pardon me, for my car takes about 18 hours to charge fully. That's a long time.
Off a
just 110
extension cord.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But the home charger that came with the car, which runs on 240 volt, takes about 4 hours to do a full charge. And then these high power stations, of which there are very few right now, it will charge for about a half an hour and give you up to like 90% charge. So that's the way to go.
Oh,
but,
wow.
But we don't have a great, there aren't many of them around. There's one in York, Maine, I know. There's one or two in New Hampshire. They're few and far between.
Right. Mm. I know that when I go into Boston and I usually get in at the Alewife station and take the T, and there's some number of spots set aside for electric vehicles.
Sure.
Are those like high power charging stations, or are they more of a trickle charge 4 hour kind of thing, or do you not know? I mean, maybe you don't know.
More often you're going to find that the roadside ones are going to be what we call like a level two or a DC fast charge. So it all depends on what we've set up in that infrastructure there. But I think that, like what you've said with the range anxiety that you have with the Leaf, we're at a point in the industry right now where I think that's going to start to go away. Once we have these cars that are coming out with a 200 plus mile range, we're really going to end up where we're living somewhere within almost a multi-day range before we need to recharge on our vehicles. And I think that's going to simplify the infrastructure overall. We're not going to be reliant on it as we would a gas station, quick run in, fill up and go.
Sure, sure. Yeah. I agree. It's within, if we were having this conversation 10 years from now, I bet we would be talking way differently. I really think there are going to be a lot of charging additions made to the infrastructure for charging.
Yeah.
And that makes a very practical, really a practical vehicle at some point.
Yeah, well, I would think that if one supermarket in every town had a charging station, that they would just make having an electric so much more feasible.
Right.
And for a supermarket, it would be like, hey, it'd be an extra draw in, I would think.
I think that's true. The one that I mentioned in Maine is at a Hannaford supermarket. There's one here at Whole Foods, as I mentioned. So, yeah, it's, right now it's still a curiosity, though, when I pull up to charge and people want to come over and talk, which is nice, and say, oh, what do you get for this? What kind of mileage do you get on this thing and that sort of thing? So it's still a novelty for most people.
The Hannaford over in York there, that's one that we installed, and that's we've been working with Hannaford to try to build out that infrastructure and partner with them, and they've been pretty receptive to that, and they can see that value. It's again just trying to create that confidence that this is the way that industry is going, and that building out that infrastructure now isn't a loss. It's
right.
Something that is really setting them apart for the future.
Yep.
and setting that up. So
yeah,
it's really cool to see some of that grow now.
Yeah. And I was mentioning to you folks before the show that I found out about electric motorcycles on Friday. And it's like, probably the listeners and you guys already know about it. But when I found out about it, I was like, a motorcycle and it's all electric? That's cool.
Well,
you can attest to this, Rob, right? You drive that Leaf, and I bet the first time you got in it and drove it, you said, okay, this is a little bit more than I thought this was going to do. It's got some torque there, can really get up and go. Match that with a little motorcycle, so that torque translates pretty well.
Yeah, it was a surprise the first time I sat in the driver's seat, because I had, I'd gone out with the gentleman at the dealership, and he drove it, and I realized he was actually babying it a little bit. I didn't realize it until I drove it. I said, this thing scared me a little bit.
Yeah.
There's no hesitation. You hit the gas and you're just pinned in your seat, basically. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. That is totally awesome. But, I've heard you know, some people are always going to be naysayers, right? So I've heard people say, well, but at the end of the day, this electric car, this really isn't so green. It's still connected up to a coal-fired plant somewhere. Right. So, I mean, what do you say to people like that?
Well, it depends on where you live, because there's information online. The Energy Information Administration publishes the mix of energy for electricity for every state. New Hampshire's actually very green if you look at all of its own generation and what it gets for renewable credits from energy generated elsewhere. Coal is basically a non-player. So I would say that it just depends on where you live.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to look at the total energy usage and generation in any particular state, and you sort of net meter that out, if that's the right way to say it, then some states are going to be dirtier than others with regard to the environment. But I think overall, it's you know, without tacking numbers on it, it's very clean, very clean.
And I would think too that if you put solar panels on the roof of your house and you charge at home, there's no coal plant associated.
No, nothing like driving on the power of the sun.
Right.
No, I think the green side of it's always a good argument, and you'll get a lot that get into it pretty deeply talking about lithium and the mining practices that need to be done to get that to come about. But really what you look at is the times that these industries have started, there's been such an awareness around sustainability in general. You know, if you look back the last 20 years, really all industries and all businesses have started to take that mindset. So with that in mind, these industries have started further down that path, and they're already aware of that cradle-to-cradle, if you would, life of their product. So the lithium industry in and of itself has really planned out that recycling of the battery and what's going to be the second life of battery. I mean, you can go now and check out the forums and find all sorts of cool things to do with your old Prius battery if you want, because really? There's still a lot left in there when it's all said and done. So, you know, for the engineers out there who like to do their own DIY projects, there's lots out there. But, you know, the recyclability, if that's even a word or if we want to go there, is a lot higher on these electric vehicles because, again, they're looking at that. We don't have the moving parts within an electric vehicle like you do in an ICE or an internal combustion engine vehicle. So it's really cool from that maintenance perspective. I mean, if you look at the long term, you're never doing an oil change. So right there, right, I mean, that's a super cool benefit, you know?
I hadn't even thought of that.
If you think of the maintenance that you don't have to do with these vehicles, I think that's appealing to such a great part of the population.
That is a great point. I got an email from the dealership after 3 months because they automatically sent it to every driver, you know, to every customer.
Yeah.
And saying it's time for maintenance, maybe it was 6 months, whatever, right? So I took it in, made an appointment, brought it in. They said, oh, this is a Leaf. No, you don't bring this in for a year. We don't need to see you for a year.
Yeah.
And then my second appointment was a year and 3 months after that. So it's all they do is basically do a battery check, grease the joints, and, you know, away you go.
And then shrug their shoulders and let you out the door, right?
That's it. Yeah.
Yep.
Now, do you still have to fill up the windshield wiper fluid reservoir?
That is, they're working on that, I'm told. So, that's a downside.
Some slight maintenance, I guess.
But no, overall, very pleased. Very pleased with it. So,
Rob, what are you looking at as maybe the upgrade from the Leaf down the line? Have you got your eye on anything else?
I am looking. We talked about the Chevy
Bolt,
right? Yeah, and that's. I actually kind of like the looks of that. I'm torn whether to stay all electric or go with a hybrid. But as the range for the electric is going up, I'm less inclined to want to go to a hybrid. So I like the idea of electric car, whether it's a hybrid or a plug-in hybrid, right? Which is something different by itself, or all electric like I have now. But I'm tempted. I'm hoping by the time I'm ready for an upgrade that it's all electric and that's practical for me.
Yeah.
You know, so, I mean, if you do let's say I very rarely take my battery down to zero, but if I do, I can charge 4 hours overnight, no problem. Well, I probably, if I have a car with twice the range, I could charge 8 hours overnight, probably no problem. So, you know, I think it could work out.
The Bolt's pretty exciting. I'm excited to see that one and take that for a ride when I get a chance.
Right.
That's the four-door small SUV.
That's pretty.
It's pretty, you know, 200 plus mile range. Yeah. It'll be an exciting.
That'll be really cool.
It has about twice the horsepower of my Leaf too,
yeah,
by the way.
Yeah. So it's got some get up and go. And you know, I think the other piece of the pie when you start talking electric vehicles is you know, the autonomous driving and everything that's coming down the line in that. You had mentioned, you know, if we were talking 10 years from now, this infrastructure conversation probably isn't going to be an issue.
Right.
But at the same time, if we were talking 10 years from now, we wouldn't have driven over here.
Right.
Our cars would have driven over here.
That's true.
We might have been able to do this from the car.
Yeah, that's true too.
That's where I think the true excitement for this is that when we see that build out, we'll start to have, you know, that autonomous vehicle, we'll start to have fleets that really, I think we're going to see car ownership go down drastically.
Yeah. And you know, if once the vehicles become autonomous, hopefully the traffic will ease, you know, maybe the machines can share the road
right.
a little bit more easily than us humans
do. They play nicer than we do.
I bet they do.
So, yeah, that's some great stuff on electric vehicles, and I'm still going to keep my eye out for that electric motorcycle. On the radio spot I was listening to, which was NHPR, by the way, the guy who was selling the electric motorcycle said that because of the torque on the engine, the electric motor, that the torque available was comparable to performance bikes.
Right.
That the internal combustion engine performance bikes.
Sure.
So I'm like, well, I'm not really, you know, I'm not really, acceleration isn't my first, you know, love for wanting a motorcycle. I just like the concept of having the air moving around me. But, you know, I'd be willing to try that out.
And it'd be quiet, you know, you could drive around, no worries. It would be 2 a.m. and not waking the neighbors up.
Yeah, exactly. And if I really wanted to hear the Harley sound, I could just pipe it into my own headphones or something.
So talking quickly, I know we're going to wrap it up, but talking about the torque and the get up and go that these vehicles have, I don't know if you guys have seen one of the cooler videos that's out on Tesla's Model X. So Tesla's Model X is their SUV. It's their bigger one. And they did a really neat little drag race with it where they drag race it against a Lotus Elise, a little supercar. And it blew the doors off.
Oh, wow.
What's considered a supercar.
Sure.
And then to step it up one more that just made it even more fun to watch was they took the Lotus Elise. They took that Model X. They put a trailer on the Model X. They put the Lotus Elise on a trailer on the Model X and then drag raced them. And the Model X still won.
Oh, wow.
So when you really get down to it, I mean, we talk about performance of these things. We talk about less maintenance. It's just trending towards a better product.
Right.
And this comes from, you know, I'm an old school gear guy. I've always loved the old cars. I've loved internal combustion engines, but you just can't deny the cool benefits coming from the new stuff.
Sure. Yeah, well, you know, my first car was a Ford Pinto, and I think I loved it because it was so quirky.
You liked it because it didn't catch fire.
Or explode, but yeah, people didn't tailgate me. But yeah, I think we are getting toward a superior product with the electric vehicles. It'll be exciting to see what happens.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Eric St. Pierre of Revision Energy. Thank you very much for coming and joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Eric.
Robert Smith of the Power and Energy Society, thank you very much for putting this month together, this radio show together.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Ed. Appreciate it.
And my name is Ed Nelson. I've been your moderator, and this has been the March edition of Tech IE. Catch you next time. Bye-bye.